This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a leading expert on the impact of Israeli policies on Gaza and the West Bank, where she's been many, many times, unlike other so-called experts. Jennifer Lowenstein, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great to get your perspective again, especially since the Israeli war on Gaza has just ended. I'm wondering what the results of that are.
Well, I think we're going to see the results over the next few years, and one of the results will be the continued downward spiral of U.S. and Israeli status in the world. I think both of them have reached all-time record lows in world public opinion, and this has contributed to that in a major way. What we don't see here on the news and what people are seeing every day, day and night, around the clock in the Middle East and in the Muslim world, and my guess is probably in other parts of the world as well, is going to come back to haunt us. I remember being in Beirut for 2 weeks. I just returned. Every day, every night, the news channels were on. Every news channel was tuned to Gaza. All of the footage was shocking. It was horrible. It was horrifying. I was just telling somebody that, you know, there's no need for spin when the footage speaks for itself. When I flew back, I stopped in London, and I noticed that in the airport, all of the televisions were tuned to the BBC, and the story on at the hour was Gaza. Israel had just fired a phosphorus, white phosphorus shells into the UN compound, one of the main UN compound in Gaza City, and claimed that it was by accident. And I was glued to the television there. And then about 8 hours later, I landed in Chicago, and I searched in vain through across the airport for a television that had world news on, and there was nothing but basketball. And all I could think of is, boy, are we going to be shocked when the reality of what we have just backed comes home to roost.
I mean, the fact of the horror there is disguised by the mainstream media, corporate media here in the United States. The fact of the U.S. backing is disguised.
Yeah.
The United States, after all, gives $3 billion a year in military aid to the Israelis, including some of those Apache helicopters and jets and a bunker buster missile that they tried out for the first time there, to say nothing of the economic support and the diplomatic support.
Constant. And again, it's hidden from us in here in the media, but it isn't hidden from the rest of the world. And that's why I say that the all-time lows in U.S. and Israeli popularity worldwide are going to only go lower. And, you know, when you see pictures of whole families murdered under the rubble of their homes, and the head of the ICRC, the Red Cross, who, you know, in general is always, and the Red Cross as an organization is always very neutral, usually very mild in its public statements. At one point, the head of the ICRC was so angry that the Israelis had taken 4 days to allow in ambulances in one area that had come under very heavy bombardment, aerial bombardment as well as tank shelling. And after 4 days, the members of the Red Cross were finally allowed in. They were not allowed to bring in their ambulances, so they had to walk into this village in northern Gaza, and they found whole families that had been killed, as well as survivors, in this case, four children, for two mothers who are dead, and the children were lying on the floor next to their dead mothers, unable to stand or sit up because they were so weak and had had no food. And the Red Cross spokesperson was just, he lashed out at the Israelis in a way I have never heard before, condemning this as a war crime. And then when they tried to get the survivors out, including those children, the ambulances were still not allowed in, and the people who they found still living were taken out in donkey carts to some of the hospitals. Now, you have a situation in Gaza where there was almost round-the-clock aerial bombardments, primarily at night. And if you can imagine a population where 750,000 people are children, 1.5 million people live in the Gaza Strip. It's got a very, very young population. Half the population is 20 years of age or younger. So this, in a sense, is a war on children. And the children are the ones who are going to bear the brunt of this onslaught. These are kids who, in one case, I called a friend who told me that his 10-year-old daughter had been at school the first day of the bombardments, which was midday on Saturday, December 27th. She was at school, and less than 30 meters away was one of the police headquarters. Not security police, not militants, not training people trained to fight the Israelis. Police people, police traffic cops. This headquarters was bombed. People in their offices, sitting behind desks, etc., were blown to smithereens.
What happened to her daughter?
This little girl witnessed it from her schoolyard and saw bodies flying up in the air and told her father about that later on. And he said that every night she would shake and shiver in bed for more than an hour before he could get her to fall asleep.
I mean, the psychological damage is just going to be astronomical.
It's unspeakable.
If you multiply that by 750,000.
Imagine this family. This is a family of three kids whose parents are incredibly loving, incredibly reassuring. They were telling me that at nighttime, the children did not just need verbal reassurance. They needed physical contact so that the family was sleeping together in a bed, so that the children could be touched. That's how terrified they were. I could hear them crying when I would call. And these are children who were living in the area of Gaza City, in western central Gaza City, called Arimal, which was the least heavily targeted in the entire city. So imagine the effect on children in the areas that were coming under shelling every single day, and in a couple of cases where people didn't know whether it was safer to stay in their homes or to leave their homes. In one case, one of the workers at the Mizan Center for Human Rights, where I used to work in Gaza City, asked his two cousins to come stay with him because he thought it was a safer place. His two cousins arrived, and no sooner did they arrive than rockets started slamming into this guy's house. The cousins realized that, you know, this is crazy. They might as well just go back home to where they were. So they left the next morning, and before they made it back to their homes, they were both killed. This is the kind of story that we were hearing on the news, on Al Arabiya, Al Manar, Al Jazeera, Lebanese broadcasting stations, day and night, with complete visual footage to follow.
What did your friend at the Human Rights Center say after he told you his cousins had been killed?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to me how when I feel I can't take it anymore, I'll call friends in Gaza and feel like I've got the strength to go on, because they keep going on. And he says, what can we do? We are living this history. We have to survive it. We have to come through it. And if we give up and die, you know, or if we just give up, a lot of people died, not because they wanted to, that's for sure. You know, then you end up betraying what you believe in most. I think he and many, many people are very, very cynical right now about the politics internally inside Palestine, as well as globally. But the most, by far, the most discouraging and disillusioning fact for them was the absolute silence of the international community. People would say things like, well, we need an immediate ceasefire, but it's never backed up with anything. The words are as hollow as, you know, as caves. Nothing was backed up by any kind of action.
My guest today is Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, just back from the Middle East. She was over there while Israel's war against Gaza was raging. I would have thought that the lack of proportionality would have struck more people here in the United States anyway, as just as the war crime that it is. Mm-hmm. It's against the Geneva Conventions. Here you had 100 Palestinians killed for every Israeli.
Far more than that. I mean, by now the death toll is somewhere around 1,300, and that's because of the number of people who have only recently, in the last 2 days since this ceasefire was called, a number of people being found dead under the rubble of their homes. So, I mean, 3 Israeli civilians for, let's see, out of 1,300, 85% of those were civilians. And when I say 85%, I want to qualify that because many people here have been told that one quarter or 50% of the casualties were civilians. This is simply not true. There are people from the 2 major human rights organizations in Gaza City who have field workers spread all out throughout the Gaza Strip, in the cities, in their refugee camps, in the villages, who verify every single case. And what happens is that any male between the ages of 16 and 40 is automatically considered a combatant. And as I said before, the civil police are non-combatants under international law. Fathers, grandfathers, school teachers, businessmen, these are not people who are part of the Hamas party who are actively training to fight Israel. So basically 15% of 1,300 casualties were legal combatants.
So then the ratio is more like 300 to 1. And
basically,
it's just this isn't an eye for an eye.
This is an all-out slaughter. And if we read carefully, most of what I know about this particular war comes not only from the Arab press and papers like the Daily Star, which is a Lebanese English language daily, but also I get a very high percentage of my news from Haaretz, which is a Hebrew, it's part of the Hebrew press. It's an English language Israeli paper. Now we can read in that paper, for example, that Ehud Barak planned the ground invasion of Gaza, and that the plans, the blueprint for a ground invasion into Gaza, first of all, have long been in the wings. And secondly, that well before the ceasefire was broken on November 4th by the Israelis, not by Hamas, these plans were ready to go.
Jennifer Lowenstein, what about the Hamas rockets that we hear all the time here in the U.S.?
Yes.
It was the position of the Bush administration that nothing's going to change until Hamas stops sending those rockets in.
And that, of course, is always the question of every Westerner who ever comes up to me and asks a question about this starts with the rockets. And it just shows you the great divide between, and I hate to say it, Middle East and West. Nobody in the Middle East asks about the rockets because it's understood that those rockets have a context, and that the context is occupation, siege, blockade, the denial of electricity, of water, of cooking gas, of fuel, of clothing, of building materials, of school supplies, of, very importantly, medical supplies, medical equipment, spare parts for generators, spare parts for intensive care unit machines. All of this has been blockaded systematically for well over 2 years. And beyond that, you have 6-7 years of an intifada in which Gaza was closed off from the world. It was almost an around-the-clock closure in Gaza for 7 years, in which when things finally got to a point that it was catastrophic, the Rafah crossing would be allowed open and people would come in and out. Before that...
This is to Egypt and back.
Right. The Rafah crossing is on the Egypt-Gaza border. It's the only international border in the Gaza Strip. Many people say that since the disengagement in 2005, the Rafah crossing is no longer controlled by Israel. This, however, is simply not true, since Israel is the power that, first of all, has lifetime video access to the Rafah crossing, and also is the power that determines when and when not the international monitors are allowed in. So basically, they usually say you can't go, and it keeps the crossing closed. But the point I was making is that the closure of Gaza began in 1991. And if you look very carefully at the history, not only of the Gaza Strip, but of the West Bank, you see a history of gradual and more intensified closure, of closing off of the territory, strangulation of cities and towns from each other, such that people no longer have access in the West Bank, for example, from village to village, from town to town, from village to hospital, from
schools. How many times have you been in Gaza, in the West Bank, Jennifer Lowenstein?
Since 1999, more than 10 times. And I go back whenever I can. I was supposed to go back this October. There was a conference organized by the World Health Organization and the Gaza Community Mental Health Project in October. And I'd been invited to it last June. I had a paper ready. I had people lined up to teach for me. And 10 minutes after I booked my ticket, I went to my computer, and there was a notice from the conference organizers that said the Israelis had barred all foreign participants from entering the Gaza Strip. The grounds for this barring is always security, and I know from firsthand experience that the only insecurity I've ever felt in Gaza comes from Israeli soldiers.
Did you have a close call with Israeli soldiers?
On more than a few occasions. In 2004, I was staying with the mayor of Rafah and his family, and this was when I was there as part of a delegation, sadly the only member to make it in, and the municipality people in Rafah had done a huge amount for us. We were intended to go to a whole bunch of different organizations, meet people, but it ended up being only me. I stayed with the mayor. His name is Saeed Zorub, and his wife and three daughters and their one son. And one evening, his wife and eldest daughter, a beautiful young girl named Nouf, who went on to study law in El Arish, I believe, or wanted to, they took me to some friends of theirs, and we were upstairs in this apartment just talking and eating and having a nice sort of very social time. And when the time came to leave, we went downstairs where there was a truck waiting for us. The mayor's driver had come to fetch us, and we walked out, and as soon as we were visible, we were fired on directly, and we could hear the bullets springing off the walls in front of us and off the walls of the house. And everybody ducked back into the, I guess you'd call it a garage. It was really the downstairs of an apartment building. I was just terrified. It was the first time I've ever experienced being fired at, literally, so, to the point where bullets were, I don't know, inches away from me. And everybody else was used to it. So they just sort of huddled there quietly and waited for silence. And when the driver said it was okay, everyone crammed into the car. Well, we all had our heads down, and the driver drove like a bat out of hell, to use the expression, until we got out of this region where it was near a no man's land where soldiers were stationed in a bunker, and they would fire at anything that moved. They had no idea whether we were soldiers, partisans, women, children, elderly. There was no way they could possibly have known.
And
they just fired at us.
That's normal, so-called normal life.
That's normal, right.
Is horrifying. The other thing we hear in the United States always is, Hamas wants to destroy Israel, won't recognize Israel. It aims to destroy it. So what can Israel do?
Right. Well, actually, this is one of my favorite questions, because because I spent a year at Oxford University in the Refugee Studies Center researching internal Palestinian politics. And one of the things I did was to collect the number of times the quotations, public quotations, by various Hamas leaders since 1988, or a year after the creation of Hamas, in which all of the major Hamas leaders, living or dead, in Palestine or in exile, have now said on one occasion or another and in public that they would accept a two-state solution on the 1967 lines. It is not an official position, and it's not an official position because Hamas fears that if they make it official, the same fate will befall them that befell Fatah. In other words, Arafat renounced terror, accepted two states, signed the Oslo Accords, and each year lost more and more and more land to the Israelis. So Hamas does not want to make it an official part of their platform. However, they have stated Khalid Meshaal, Mahmoud Zahar, Ismail Haniya, Osama Hamdan, everyone, including those who are dead, including Sheikh Yassin, Abdulaziz Rantisi, Ismail Abu Shanab, these were the leaders of Hamas for many, many years. There's not one of those leaders that did not publicly say, we would accept a two-state solution with Israel, a Palestinian state on the pre-1967 borders. That, to me, is criminal, that this information is completely blocked out of the news here.
Yeah, it's just not part of the propaganda frame, is it?
It doesn't. People don't know what to do with it when I give it to them, because they just know that Hamas, which is supported by Iran, which wants Israel wiped off the face of the earth, and says in its charter that it's for Israel's destruction, that's all that they hear. That's all that they know. And when you counter that information with factual information from a variety of sources, including sources such as the Washington Post and the New York Times, by the way, not just obscure Arabic journals. In fact, most of what I collected came from Western-based reports, including those of the International Crisis Group based in Brussels.
Jennifer Lowenstein, I read the congressional resolutions that came out during the Gaza war, and they all contain that bit of propaganda very
right.
high up in the whereases
yes.
that these congressional resolutions have.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing about the one in the Senate and the one in the House, other than that, was that they passed – well, the Senate one passed unanimously.
Phenomenally.
And the one in the House passed with only five people voting against it, and it was Representatives Gwen Moore and Maxine Waters and Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul and Nick Rahal,
mm-hmm.
the only five people courageous enough to oppose a resolution that blamed everything on Hamas,
mm-hmm.
including – in the House resolution anyway, all the deaths of Palestinian
right.
civilians were
yes.
laid at the foot of Hamas.
And this to me is so criminal, it's beyond words. The Israelis, the spokespeople on the Israeli side have been claiming since the start of this slaughter that Hamas members had been launching rockets deliberately from crowded, densely crowded areas and using civilians as human shields. Well, first of all, Gaza is the most densely populated area of land on the face of the earth. When people are told to evacuate their neighborhoods and go somewhere safe, the question on everyone's mind is, where are we supposed to go? Secondly, the film footage that we have and that the Israelis have of Hamas rocket launchers and Hamas members firing these rockets show these men in orchards and fields, not anywhere near people. And finally, all of the claims about human shields and densely populated areas come from the Israelis. There is no independent investigative reporting that backs up these reports. And just like in Lebanon in 2006, when the same charge was made against Hezbollah, I believe that after a certain amount of time, when journalists are finally let back into Gaza, they will discover the same thing that independent investigative reporters discovered in Lebanon, which is that contrary to what the Israeli propaganda machine was saying, the Hezbollah fighters took extensive precautions and went out of their way to fire rockets from places that were as far away from civilian populations as possible. That's what I believe is true in Gaza as well. Hamas members want to build support. They don't want to lose it. To fire rockets from densely populated areas goes completely against their interests, and I personally don't believe it and won't believe it unless I have independent confirmation.
Do you think Hamas has gained or lost influence as a result of this war?
I think it's very difficult to say. We have to remember that Hamas was not elected in 2006 because it was Hamas, because it was an Islamic organization. Palestinians are among the most secular of any Arab groups in the Middle East. They were elected as a protest against Fatah and its corruption. And there's no question of that when you look at the voting records available. Almost everyone who voted for Hamas, with the exception of a small core of ideologues, had previously been supporters of Fatah, the PFLP, the DFLP, other organizations that are considered secular and leftist. People voted for Hamas because they felt it was the only party that took their own interests into consideration. During the Second Intifada, for example, it was Hamas and a very vast system of welfare charity organizations that fed and clothed and housed people who were losing their homes, who couldn't afford to eat anymore, who didn't have the supplies to clothe their own children, to get their children to schools or to get vaccinations. Hamas clinics were doing these for free. So people started to believe that maybe this organization will actually respond to our needs. Well, unfortunately, when Hamas got into power, it basically became a miniature Fatah in a very quick amount of time. It is a fairly corrupt organization. It's not one I would like to have governing me. I don't like the Islamic ideology that governs it, nor do I like the manifestations of that ideology in society, on women, on families, etc. But I do believe that it was wrong of the United States and Israel to basically nullify the results of a democratic election when, in fact, it was a very democratic, transparent election. And when Hamas came to power, we forget history very quickly. The first move they made and the first action they tried to create was a national unity government in which Fatah members and other members of other factions would become part of the new government leading the PLC.
Jennifer Lowenstein, we only have about a minute left. The thing that keeps hitting my brain listening to you is why did Israel do this and why did the U.S. support them if ultimately it's so irrational, both for Israel's security and for the security of Americans?
Well, you know, and that's a question that can be dealt with for a long time. Too bad we only have a minute. But the fact of the matter is, and I wrote an entire article on this, if Hamas did not exist, this would have happened just the same. The reason is because Israel is an expansionist power. It seeks the land, the resources of the West Bank. It does not want any kind of resistance in its back door, on its gates. It wants to suppress any kind of indigenous move for national liberation. That's what Hamas has now come to represent. Any group in power that does not take orders from Israel is going to be the enemy of Israel, and the Israelis or the Americans will go after it in the same exact way.
Unsustainable, though, long term.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the time we have, unfortunately. My guest has been Jennifer Lowenstein, the Associate Director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jennifer Lowenstein, thanks so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.